Hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and that was just Etta James, I'd Rather Go Blind. A lot of you ask who I play at the beginning of most shows, and that's who I play. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And my guests today are fiction writer Ron Carlson and Barry Kibrick, host of KLCS-TV's Between the Lines. First up is Ron Carlson. He's been with us before, and I'm delighted to have him back. He teaches creative writing at Arizona State University and lives in Scottsdale. His stories have been much anthologized, and they've appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, Playboy, Gentleman's Quarterly, Plowshares, and other magazines. He has several collections of short stories. The latest is A Kind of Flying, published by Norton. He also has a novel, young adult novel, Speed of Light, recently out. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you, Barbara?
Good, how are you?
Excellent.
You know, as I was reading off the magazines that your work has appeared in, and we've probably talked about this before, but I wanted to talk about it again. You've cracked the major markets. Did you ever undergo rejection, or were you just one of the lucky ones who sort of sent their work out there and was taken right away?
I like your phrase, first of all, cracked the major markets, because so many times, when I was a young writer, you'd send your story out and someone would say, well, publish it, and then it would be the last issue for those guys. But I think that I've been fortunate, or whatever it is, to publish a high percentage of my work, but rejection is rejection, and everybody has it. It's you know all about it. I think that the issue is, for writers, you have to play through that. Every week or month or something, somebody says, oh, this story isn't right, and either it isn't right, that is, you haven't finished it right, or it's not right for them. I remember sending a story to Tri-Quarterly 25 years ago, and it was about a really sweet story that was published later about an old janitor and his wife, and so it was just their marital life, and it was real tender, and he was about to retire, and the rejection letter said from Tri-Quarterly said, sorry, this is not right for our men in combat issue. And I think that many times rejection is that you'll send a story to the Atlantic Monthly, and if you've been looking at the Atlantic Monthly for a few years, you start to see there's certain kinds of stories they're not going to do. And so it's, but you can't let it affect you. You've got to, I mean, the biggest issue for any writer is to finish your work and to play through.
So when that does happen, though, rejections come in, are you at that point committed to the story so that it doesn't much matter, you'll just send it out again, or do they ever affect you to the point where you go, you know, I just don't even want to work on this one again?
Well, first of all, I think the best This is a delicate matter we're speaking about, and I'm not going to be glib, but the issue is that everything I write, I mean, I have a personal connection to. And I'm looking for writers who have a personal connection to their work. I don't mean something torn from the confessional, but I mean something that matters to them in some way. Sometimes it's just imaginative. I've written a series of stories recently, you know, the main characters are Ron and Elaine. And my name's Ron, and my wife's name is Elaine. And I'm just, you know, I'm being incredibly indulgent, but I get to be. That's part of it. Well, these stories aren't for everybody. I mean, you know, I get these letters back, and instead of whatever the person says, it should just be a series of question marks because they don't get it. And then I have to decide, well, is it me or is it them? And the answer is it's me. So you write something, you have to be connected to it. Later, maybe a year or two, the story's older, then you can see, then I can begin to see the promises that could be amplified within it. But if it's written in the warmth and intensity that I'm thinking about for the writer, where everything's been paid attention to, everything's alive, then it's very difficult immediately upon finishing or sending it, we're talking about the marketplace now, to understand what you've got. And for me, one of the interesting things about rejection or even editorial work with editors is how difficult it is for me to decipher what's being said to me about this lovely thing I've created. And I read those letters with color. I have these color pencils, and the only reason I have these color pencils is to color on these letters. I get saying, well, we're going to do this, remove that. And the language, you know, it's a little bit like the way people talk about movies and in meetings. It's way beyond metaphor. I mean, it's what are you saying exactly? Should I just cut a page? Should I cut page 5? Should I make the story colder? Is it set? I mean, do I need to change the ages of the characters for whatever reason? I mean, and then you've got to decide if you trust, and that's a very personal word too, the advice you're getting.
Hmm. And I suppose you hope to work with somebody, with an editor, either at your publisher or at a journal that you do trust.
Well, this is a huge thing to say. I'm just going to say it, even though we're talking in public, that I've learned to listen, and it was big for me because I was so stubbornly self-reliant for so long. Someone said, even if they probably say, well, I say, oh, just take it. Give it back to me. And now I listen to see, and everybody has good ideas. My work is not committee work. I'm not going to make the guy younger because all the actors who could play him might be younger. That's insane. And I'm not going to write for market. I never did it. I haven't written one story for market in all these 100 I've published. And I remember when Harper's Magazine decided to publish that story, The Chromium Hook, which is one of my favorites. It was such an idiosyncratic and indulgent experience writing that story. And I got the letter and read the letter, so they were going to publish it, and I turned to my wife and I said, well, that's their problem. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think you write it as well as you can. It's a story that you could write. It was your story. If someone else could have written it, I would prefer to let them. It's too much work. And then you hope for the best. The market isn't a single thing, but increasingly, as I'm sure other guests on your program have noted, the marketplace is increasingly focused, increasingly monolithic, and there's still, for a short story writer, lots of small magazines, and I continue to meet incredibly bright readers and writers everywhere I go, and so I have a lot of hope for that, but it isn't like the old days in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s when there were still sort of a variety of magazines where you got paid a little bit, and you could get your clothes clean and take somebody to dinner, and now it's different.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Ron Carlson, and his latest collection of short stories is called A Kind of Flying, published by Norton. You have so many wonderful short stories and collections. What drew you to the form as opposed to, say, starting out with novels?
Well, I'm a story writer. I mean, I wrote a story today. I mean, it's just, I don't know what to say about it. It's what I've become. I love the idea of going in to a story with an impulse that I sort of understand, and I need to write as far until I can no longer touch bottom, and I'm all of a sudden then I begin to encounter things I couldn't see from the beginning of the story. And the writing itself is a kind of discovery. It is, not kind of. It is a total discovery process. And it takes that thing, attention. It takes fierce attention. I don't look at my notes. I don't have to look at the outline. And story writing is story writing. It would be, there are novelists who did it. Wallace Stegner's agent, when he went to New York, they were going to publish that first book. And he said, "What else have you got?" The agent did. I think it was a woman. And he said, "Well, I've got these stories." And she said, "Oh, for God's sakes, Wally, don't write stories. That's spending your principal, using up all those beginnings and all those endings." And so I don't know about that. I know that I just finished a novel now that'll be published next year, but it was a different kind of writing, and it has my attention, and I respect it with just every bone in my body, and it's dear in its way, but I love the stories, and I love them. I mean, it's so interesting what they've taught me and the journeys we've made together as I've gone in and tried to find out what they might be, whether they were comic or serial comic or serious. So I didn't answer your question. Sometimes in schools we say, if we're going to write a story, just show me what it is and I'll write one. But there are lots of people writing stories right now, as you know, and they're being guided by the writer that's loudest in their head. I mean, I just read a whole series of stories by a young guy who's 20, and he's so obviously infatuated with Dennis Johnson's short stories from Jesus Son that you can hear it in every paragraph, and it's kind of a nice way to start. You start with that, then you hit this young writer will add somebody else. I mean, for a while in the 80s, everyone, 70s and 80s, everyone was under the influence of Ann Beatty and then Ray Carver, and now I see certain other writers emerge. And so you read as widely as you can, and it creates a kind of trajectory for your career as you emulate and you create from whole cloth, not exactly, but you try to your own worlds.
Yeah, I think new writers sometimes worry about being derivative of their favorite writers, instead of looking at it as if you're playing music, you're going to start playing composers, you're going to play songs written by others. You're not going to sit down and write your own.
Exactly. No, you need. I mean, the word derivative, the word originality, is cut in a strange cachet, and derivative has got. You've got to. All books come from books. One of the most original writers in America, Cormac McCarthy, said that. When I looked at that, such an interesting thing. And then, of course, when you read his work, you can see. He seems to me to be an original, but there's certain elements of the Old Testament in there, and bits of Hemingway and others, Faulkner certainly, but. I read a lot of young writers who they'll drop their manuscript and they say, "This is like nothing you've ever read." I say, "Well, what's it like?" They say, "I want to sell this book." I said, "Well, go find a book that it's like." They said, "It's like nothing else. It never was." And of course, you read it, there is a chance that it's like something else. But that's the way we learn and read. Not everything has been written yet. We're still evolving. The writers are part of the change committee. We're supposed to describe what's happening to us as a society and as a people.
Mm-hmm. Do you read while you're working on a story or a novel?
I have to. I'm one of the highest paid readers in the country. I make my living as a teacher and a reader, and I read way too much. I don't know. People say, "What do you read for pleasure?" And I don't know that I've ever read anything that wasn't kind of pleasurable. I'm an analytical reader, and 18 months ago, since we talked, and then later after that, I judged the Penn Faulkner last year, a year ago. Mm-hmm. At this time, I was in Washington. But for that, you read 325 books from September to May, which, if you do the math, is 4.5 books a day. And I want to say a couple things about it. One is, good for me, but B, I'll never do anything like it again. I'll judge for a high school if I can. I don't know, listen to the band, but the this is just, that was crazy.
And well, why do you do it?
At the end of that period, I just, I went to a writer's conference in Aspen the following week, and someone said, "Would you read my book?" I said, "Take your book and move over there." I was just, that was it. All those books, and it was really quite a forced education. most of it happy, but some of it, there are a lot of books. The book is a consumer item, of course, and so a lot of books fall very, very clearly into genre. I mean, even literary books fall into genre. We have all kinds of comments now and all this big talk about chick lit, which is such a dismissive phrase, and I'm not sure. It's a market term, I guess, but and market terms are always reductive, but it's tough. I don't know that, I'm not exactly sure what I'm getting at here, except to say that it's, writer writes her book the best she can. It should be individual to her. It should be her book. There shouldn't be an evil developer in her. There shouldn't be any of the same kind of courses from mainstream thought that we see again and again. And I try to keep, as I said, and it's maybe the truest thing I'll say in our talk today, is that I keep the market absolutely out of my room. Mm. It's absolutely out of my room because, first of all, I wouldn't know what it was. And I couldn't write you a story that would please you. I mean, I could work for weeks. I could write a story, but, you know, then you could come to it. You bring what you can bring to it.
Sure. It's interesting. I think all the categorizing that goes on, yeah, I think writers sit down and so many have the market just swimming in front of them. What shelf is this going to go on? And do I need to think about that now?
And
it seems to do not much good.
No, I think it's in the way. I think it's in the way. Letting anybody in your room is a way. You know, letting the your minister in the room or your ex-wife, it just, you're either going to write toward them or against them and try to go the long way around. It's just you've got to be true to what you're saying.
Yeah.
So
you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Ron Carlson, author of many books. The latest collection is A Kind of Flying, published by Norton. In my book, in Pen on Fire, you talked about keeping quiet about your work. And this comes up over and over with writers, with students. You know, how much to talk about your work before you finish it. You know, do I bring my short story? Do I bring my novel, even though I've only written three chapters? Do I start bringing it to a critique group before I've written the fourth chapter? What do you say to all that?
Well, first of all, the goal is to survive the draft. And so for the conventional wisdom, and I think it is conventional, and I think there is some wisdom in it, is to not let anybody else bend the tree. I mean, but a lot of people are coming out of the cold of it and working alone. They need some support. And so they have a group, they bring in six pages, and they hear, you know, they get a little support so that that acts as a kind of a support for a young tree that's trying to grow. But if you have 25 pages and you think you understand that what you've got is the character's a conniving husband, then that has your attention, and you go to the group and they say, well, couldn't he be more sympathetic? And so I worry about people in the 25, 35, 45 page zone letting other people get their hands on this thing. And writing, has been said 1,000 times, is a lonely sport, and you're going to be out in it alone, and you're going to have to say, the person who needs to believe your book is you. And so I love support. I love people who are, say, I'm all for it, press on, and not just blind support, but the suggestion. But writing is not a committee. I mean, you're going to bring what you know to that book. If they have craft ideas for you, say, no, your dialogue is too choppy, or you're going to need to sort this. Or if there's logistical confusions, which there often are, then a group can help you square that up, especially a person who's in her apprenticeship. But so it's mixed. I mean, I think you have to do. It would be death for me to bring a story in 8-9 pages and say, "What? How am I doing?" I would never touch it again. I just couldn't. I'm interested in reading it, and I do read my own work, and then I send it out, and someone else reads it. If you complete it well, then someone else might read it. So
what do you do though when you know to escape the danger of talking about it too soon, showing it too soon, but needing something? you know?
Well, you go back. Most of these groups, most of the groups I know about with well-known writers and beginning writers are made up of people who trust each other, and that's that word again. And I think that you have like-minded people, people who are kindred in some way, and they can talk to each other. But in many public workshops or community workshops or school workshops, it isn't that way. It's you're not going to get they're not going to meet you where you're living and bring you forward into your work. They're going to meet your work, and then it's very difficult. I mean, it's going to be up to you to listen with a shield. And people need to get the support they need. I work alone, and it's been I've had a couple of readers over the years, and my wife is an expert reader and editor. But I've learned that especially when I get excited about a work. When I feel all this voltage, I can feel it. And I'll write 8, 9, 10 pages, and she'll come home, and I'll run down with these pages, and I'll say, hey, you know. And she's looking at me up from over a cup of coffee thinking I'm thinking. I'll read a couple pages, and she'll go, you know, just open your mouth. That's it. That's enough to stop me. But, you know, my wife's a brilliant editor, and she knows every comma by name. And so I'm careful. You know, she can read it later when I've had all my fun with it. She'll find all the wrong commas and the repeated words and illogical transitions and that good stuff.
Are there mistakes that you see new writers making over and over? Are there common mistakes?
There are. You know, everybody sees them. That's this. You see best-selling writers do it. I mean, I read a best-selling book the other day and interviewed the writer on this little television show I do here in Arizona, and the writer had sold 40 million copies of these books, and he's very successful, and he's actually a good guy, and he's founded a literacy foundation. But in his novel, he had the phrase, made their way 23 times. Now, isn't that awful for me to say that? I mean, it's just, what am I? But no, they made their way here, they made where they're, and they exchanged glances 13 times. And the story must better be great to allow such approximate writing. And I'm looking for a book that's a little more attended to. There's been just a little more attention, and it reminds me, I mean, of a book that's written by staff that or dictated or something. And so that made your way is one of the phrases beginning writers make. And not that this guy's a beginning writer, but then and there's always a story. I'm so jaded, aren't I? But there's always the story that I said, don't write me this story. I don't want to read this story. And the title I don't want to read is The Gift. I don't want to read that story anymore. I read it 7 times a year. Call it anything else, but don't call the story The Gift. And then there's all the general stuff that comes out after two or three stories. A person starts to burn off this stuff, and the only way to do it is to burn it off by writing the soft kind of mistakes, the invisible phrases, which like made their way, which is not exactly a cliche, but should be, and other kinds of soft writing where I'm not talking about screwing things up until there's a baroque serif on every page, but I'm talking about making the sentence really serve. And if it means to stall, have it stall. If it means to thrust, have it thrust. So.
Oh, well, you know, this half hour has flown by. And I wonder if you would offer some words of wisdom.
Well, I was thinking as we were talking about this, you know, John Fante wrote a book, Ask the Dusk, which became kind of shortly popular. All his fiction was published posthumously by Black Sparrow Press. But I always like Ask the Dusk because the guy wanted to be a writer with all his teeth. And he'd go down to the library, and this paragraph is from Ask the Dusk. It's very short. It goes, a day and another day and the day before in the library with the big boys in the shelves, old Dreiser, old Mencken, all the boys down there, and I went to see them. Hiya, Dreiser. Hiya, Mencken. Hiya, hiya. There's a place for me, too, and it begins with B in the B shelf. Arturo Bandini. Make way for Arturo Bandini. His slot for his book. And I sat at the table and I just looked at the place where my book would be, right there close to Arnold Bennett. Not much, that Arnold Bennett. but I'd be there to sort of bolster up the bees, old Arturo Bandini.
That's great.
Yeah, that's the way you feel sometimes. You know, that's still the way I feel about it. I mean, this little story I wrote today, and there's such joy in it. What is that? I don't get it. And or maybe I get it, but I'm still doing it.
Well, thank you so much.
It's great to talk to you. Good luck with everything.
And thank you, and please
your projects.
Come back.
We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. That was Ron Carlson, and we'll be back in a minute with Barry Kibrick. Stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And we were here during the first half with Ron Carlson, and we are back with Barry Kibrick. Before we go on, though, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. At 24 years of age, Barry Kibrick became the youngest anchorman for the ABC-affiliated stations when he started his career as a news anchor for KIMO-TV in Anchorage, Alaska. Barry was the first person to film and televise the entire Iditarod race, which is a 1,400-mile dog sled race from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska. His footage aired nationally on ABC's American Sportsman and has been covered by ABC's Wide World of Sports since that time. Gosh, he has done so much with TV. He formed his own production company where he wrote and produced Health Facts, the Emmy Award-winning news series about science and health for KNBC. At KNBC, he went on to produce the Los Angeles Emmy Award Show, the National Emmy Nomination Ceremony, the Emmy-nominated late-night comedy series It's Fritz, and the weekly news satire series called What a Week. Barry also created the NBC syndicated series Late Night with David Viscott. Viacom approached Barry to create five specials for the Comedy Channel. One featured comic Bill Maher and became the template for the series Politically Incorrect. Barry created and produced the USA Network Sci-Fi Channel direct response series The Sci-Fi Trader. And it was here where he introduced the concept of interviewing authors and offering viewers signed first edition copies via an 800 number. Barry Kibrick launched Between the Lines in 1996 on station WYCC-TV in Chicago. Between the Lines features authors and offers signed first editions to viewers. The show is entering its eighth season and can be seen three times a week in Los Angeles on two stations and twice a week in Chicago and San Francisco. Barry currently hosts and produces series and specials for KLCS-TV Los Angeles. His current shows made history when three were nominated for Best Host and Show in the 1999 NAPBE Iris Awards competition. Barry has won two Emmys, and his productions have earned over a dozen Emmy nominations. Hi, Barry.
Hey, Barbara. How are you?
I'll tell you, how is it to listen to all this stuff about yourself?
You know, it is so awkward. In fact, I realized also it's an old bio. I need to update it because when we landed in our new home at KLCS, we no longer sell the books.
Oh, really?
No, we are supported by the station, and that was something that we did prior to our involvement with KLCS. And now that we're with them, it's a regular PBS series.
Interesting. So tell me how you, I mean, what more went into creating Between the Lines? Had you always been just an intense reader and
no.
a lover of books?
No, absolutely. That wasn't the way. In the bio, it actually is the way it came about. I was producing a show called The Sci-Fi Trader. And on that particular episode, we noticed that books and signed books by the people were the interesting thing that actually moved. You know, the old saying about television will destroy our minds. Well, the truth of the matter is many readers watch television, and they really found that it was a great thing. And I had a longtime partner named Joel Bailey, and he was my first co-producer of the series. We both worked and helped create that particular show. And then we decided, listen, this works so well. We had an acquaintance who used to be at NBC, Carol Cartwright, who went to Chicago. She said, you know, we always liked your productions, and if you've got something for us, we would air it. And basically, the long and short of it, as I said, I have a great concept for books. I think books on television would be an interesting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to afford a host. She gave us the airtime, so I stepped in to host the show. And that's how it got started. Joel Bailey booked our first author was Mario Puzo, and it's been going on since then.
So how do you choose your guests?
Well, at first it was a big effort. My associate producer, my co-producer, he had to get the guests because we were unknown. Now we don't do anything. I just get the authors are calling me and their publicists call me. And then what I do is I take, we get between 50 and 75 submissions a week. We tape on a certain day and we base, we take a look at the books, see what will work for the show in far as balance. Sometimes we pass on good books because we've just done a book like it and we want to try to, you know, give a broad a net of ideas and concepts. And then if those authors are in town and they can be there on the day we tape, that's how we do it.
Interesting. There are so many books being published, and as you said, you receive so many a week. How do you get down to it? There's five books, and you go, all of these are wonderful books, all of these authors would be great,
right?
But we can only do one of them.
Okay.
Then what happens?
All right, well, let's assume that all five authors can actually be in Los Angeles at the time we're doing our taping. Don't forget, they've got to fit in our schedule as well.
Yes.
So let's assume all five authors. It's kind of, there's two ways of looking at it. If there's an author that is so renowned and outstanding that I just personally and my viewers I know are just going to want to meet this man or this woman, then that person's going to take a priority right off the bat. If it's something where, let's say, the authors are of equal stature, by that I mean simply as far as the way the public knows them, we're not going to judge their individual writing styles or anything. As far as that would be concerned, we would then take a look at the topics and the subjects, and then once it's narrowed down, I then go over each one of the books, and the books that I think I can use that would be able to allow me to create a conversation that I want to discuss, that's the way it really gets done. It's a very selfish way in a certain way, but it's the one that I feel I want to discuss, the subject I want to talk about, and written as well as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there'll be a subject that may not be written as well, but I want to talk about it.
Sure. Do you ever have anybody on that that you really are not interested in as an author or even their book, but you know that the viewers will be? And if so, then how do you deal with that so that you can do a good interview, you can give them fair representation and have it go well so that perhaps it doesn't matter how much you like this author?
Well, you know, it's, boy, I try not to really second guess my viewers. I look at my viewers, and I think the only safe way of doing it is to look at them what I would like.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I do what I would like and hope the viewers like it. I don't try to think what they would like. There's no way I think anyone can do. I think the biggest problem with television nowadays is people trying to figure out what the viewers like rather than doing what they would like to do. And so I don't really run into that problem, because I already have taken out that step. Now, there are times when I find that there may be a topic of such importance that I may personally not be associated with, but I think the subject is of such importance. Then again, I would just, I read whatever guest comes on my show, if it's an author, which is 99.9% of my guests, their book is read from the book flap to book flap, from, you know, every footnote, every index, every reference I go through. So for me to construct a conversation, it becomes almost like it's my book.
Mm-hmm.
And it really works in a very unique way, and I think the authors sense it very much, and so does then the viewer vicariously through my conversation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Barry Kibrick, who is host of Between the Lines, a wonderful book show on KLCS-TV Los Angeles. Is there a difference, or can there be a difference between a great guest and a great book?
Gosh, totally. Totally. By the way, may I just add that we're on every night at 7 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay, and Sundays at 11 o'clock. Just wanted to.
Excellent.
I have to plug my stuff. I have a great station. It's one of the beautiful places to work. So, yes, that happens not as often. A lot of people think that might happen a lot. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen where I am so taken by the book and the author. Sometimes the author gets thrown because I'm so taken by the book. I'm like almost into it as much as the author is, and sometimes the conversation on a very rare occasion, the conversation I find never goes bad, but it doesn't live up to my expectations. Sometimes I'm expecting this is going to be the greatest conversation I've ever had because this book is so awesome, and that doesn't happen. And then sometimes I say, boy, I wish I had some more stuff to work with. And the conversation does turn out very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
So that does happen.
Have you ever had to deal with somebody you thought might be a wonderful interview and you ask a ton of open-ended questions and it seems that they find a way to answer most of them with a yes or a no?
No, I'm blessed. I never have that problem. I'll tell you why. I never ask a question. That's why I keep saying it's a conversation. It's not an interview, because I find that I like to take the author's words and their work that they spent so much time and heart and soul, and just springboard off of it conversation points. So there's no question for them to answer yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never now. I will tell you, even with that in mind, one out of 200, and I'm not going to mention this person's name, who, by the way, is extremely talented, rich, and famous, but no name mentioned. And I wove so much into what he wrote and tried to elicit just some emotions from him, some comments about any of his work, and I just got, oh, yes, that's it. So I would say something, trying to elicit something, and he'd go, oh, yeah, I see that. So it did happen to me once, but it was never quite a yes or no. But it did only once, though, I must say.
Huh. So it sounds like you don't you don't script your shows so much as you are, like you said, you read the books and you know the books so that you could probably talk endlessly about the books.
Correct.
Without having to plan, okay, I'm going to ask this question, then this question,
right.
We'll follow up with this.
Right. I don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When you created this show, were there other book shows that you either loved or really disliked, and so kind of formed your show based on what you knew?
No. The way this came about was we were doing this other show, and I created the style of the show the way I've created all my shows, which again were, you know, doing what I thought would be the best way to get the kind of messages across the, you know, the airwaves. And it was, I never saw a book show. I wasn't trying to emulate anyone. I was just coming upon my own style. So that wasn't an issue really for me, at least at the time. I just wanted to make sure, the one thing I wanted to insist upon, that was the production quality was of always a broadcast network quality production. Oftentimes, book shows tend to be very locally originated in cable stations and things like that. I did want to be certain that the production qualities were at the standard of all the network and broadcast shows that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very important element to maintain.
Now, I read somewhere that the set is designed as your living room.
Yes, well, I only wish my living room looked so nice. The set is designed of the living room that I would desire. And why it looks so much like my living room, just that my living room is not as spacious as my set is because when we shot the first few episodes, we had to shoot them in the house. We didn't have enough money to rent a location, so we used my own home. And when it came out so nice, we decided that when we had the opportunity, every time we would build the sets in the studio, we would at least model conceptually our house and just keep approving the accoutrements. So I have a nice credenza where I might have just a regular bookshelf in my home.
That's great. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here with Barry Kibrick, creator and host of Between the Lines on KLCS-TV Los Angeles every night at 7, and Sundays at
Sundays at 11 o'clock. You know what? I'm thinking that I'm not on when you're talking like that, Barbara.
You're
Sundays
here.
At 11 o'clock.
You are here. We are a university station that I'm sitting here engineering the show, and it's raw and live.
You know something? When I started my show, it was really just a two-person operation. It was myself and my partner, Joel. And it's very funny. It's such a great coincidence. It's St. Patty's Day, and he's coming over for corned beef and cabbage later. So it's going to be a great thing. But we did start it out of the living room, and it grew from there. So
yeah.
I know what it's like to engineer your own show.
Tell me about this, because I know so many authors who concern themselves with this, and that is whether they are telegenic enough, whether people booking book shows or any sort of talk shows worry about their guests looking right for TV. Now, on radio, we don't have to worry about it.
Right.
But on TV, how much, or do you worry about it, or do you think of it at all?
Well, you know, I do worry about it on one level, and that is to make my guests look as good as possible. We have at KLCS-TV, I'm blessed again with great engineers who know how to light in such a manner that is unbelievable. I have a makeup artist, I'll just say her first name, Chung. I don't want to mention her last name because I just don't know if that's appropriate. But and she could make anyone look unbelievable, and I'll tell you, it's amazing what she does. And the people there, and then my wife, who is my executive producer, and my staff make the author extremely comfortable at all times. And usually by that, throughout that, you know, process of them seeing what the set's going to look like and seeing how gorgeous it looks, seeing the professional qualities, how they're greeted by the family, by the staff, they really get into a situation that allows them to, I think, look their best. At least I've been told that.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that authors should go through, say, training, presentation training, or speaking training before they do shows?
I totally don't. I think, in fact, that ends up, I could always tell when the author did that, that ends up more that the author then is almost like he's on a political or she's on a political stump.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got their stuff nailed down. They're going to give me their rap. And in my case, that does not work for my show. I can't speak for other things that are out there, maybe because of the way other programs are conducted. That might be the appropriate thing to do, but that wouldn't work for the way I produce the program.
So what would be some of the things that, I mean, apart from, say, doing a professional training course that makes you more appropriate for TV or radio, what are some of the things that you might suggest authors do or not do when they're on a show?
Okay, the first thing that I would think that, at least it's been my experience, and my wife will testify to this, she's been in every one of the tapings, is if that author is passionate about the subject they wrote about, then that author is going to look very good on my show. Now, if they're not passionate about their topic or their writing or their subject, no matter what training that author gets, I don't believe that author is going to look right.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's advice to authors, be truly passionate about your material, and I always think you will look, again, I can only speak for my show in this case.
Sure.
You will look great on my show.
Do you do any sort of, say, pre-interview or any kind of preparation so authors know what they're going to talk about or what you're going to talk about with them?
Absolutely not. In fact, I always tell my authors, I don't, except for a nice hello and a little breakdown on what's about to take place, I don't speak to them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And my first experience has become the reason I explain to them is my first interview with Mario Puzo, I was so nervous. I did go over everything with him. And in just as if it was something out of The Godfather, when the camera started rolling and I asked my first thing, he said, "Didn't we already discuss this?"
Right.
So, no. It's a surprise to them as it is to me when it occurs.
Well, I guess that is the danger, isn't it? Because if you go over what you're going to talk about, then you've talked about it, and so then the show could very easily seem contrived.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I never do.
Interesting.
And again, I can't say that's the same. I mean, if there's authors listening and tomorrow they're going to be on Larry King or the next day on the Today Show, I think that experience is very different. I just want to be clear about that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I find the same things. Sometimes, especially publicists want to know what we're going to talk about. And I say, listen, it's like we're sitting on a couch, we're having a conversation, and listeners get to listen in. And,
I think that's the best way to go.
I like it. We have a few minutes left with Barry Kibrick, who is creator and host of Between the Lines on KLCS-TV Los Angeles. Do you think that male interviewers and female interviewers are different or have a different style or come at guests differently?
I do think there are certain, there may be reasons why that might happen, but I think, again, it's more based on how you approach the subject itself. I think, if there was a woman who had my point of views, probably like yourself, I think you and I might conduct a similar type of situation. So I would probably differ as much from Larry King as you might from Katie Couric.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I may be very similar, but we probably both differ from those. So I would say it's more on the attitudes that we bring to the table, where that may be based upon our sexual experiences or our gender, then maybe there is something in that regard. But otherwise, I would think it's more just our own personal attitudes.
Mm-hmm. How about, we have a couple of minutes left, and there's so much I would love to talk to you about.
Well, you're going to have a chance. Can we plug your appearance on my show?
We can.
Yes, you're coming on with your book, and I'm so excited about it. Do we? You know what? We can't give the date because we only know the date we're taping it. That's not going to do any good for anybody
right
out there.
Someday I'll tell them.
You'll tell them, though, okay?
I can't wait.
Okay.
But what makes for a successful interview? Are there qualities that you see as being common? Is there a certain chemistry that perhaps you and a guest have, or is it that a guest is passionate about their book, their topic, and they're able to convey that, and you love it as well? But what is it?
I swear I want to say all of the above, Barbara. Every single point you hit is exactly what makes those interviews very good. So, you know, if the chemistry is there, if the author has the passion over the topic, I think the way, as I said, we're lucky, the way I conduct the process itself leaves, fortunately, little room for error because it's by nature that way. So I think all of the above. It's you know, if the author is passionate about the subject matter, we have a chemistry. It's going to make for a great interview, and I'm fortunate to say that almost all of them have that.
Is there anyone you've interviewed that really kind of sticks out above the rest?
You know, I would never want to say that because mm-hmm. I will say one thing, because there is someone that sticks out above the rest, but not because of the book they wrote or their even the conversation, but just as a person. I had the blessings to interview Richie Havens,
mm-hmm.
and I'll never forget when he walked into the station, the presence that he had seemed very different from anyone I met before. Now, I can say that about other people. I have, because I've interviewed the Queen of Jordan, and Queen Noor has a presence that no one else has ever had. I've interviewed Ray Bradbury and all these phenomena, Elmore Leonard and Joseph Wambaugh, and I mean, there's so many I can't even go on. They all have their own individual, unique presence. Sidney Sheldon, my gosh, I mean, it's unbelievable when these people enter a room. But when Richie Havens entered the room, there was something so spiritual about this fellow that the presence was even very different. And I can't describe it any other way than that.
Hmm.
So if there was one, he always comes to our mind when we discuss, you know, who would be, because there's so many great moments. And by those even that whose names we don't know, and some who aren't even mainly authors, Ray Manzarek of The Doors.
Yes.
We had just a wonderful time together and hit certain notes together. Jan Goldstein, who most people wouldn't even know, but who wrote a wonderful book, Sacred Wounds. We hit it off and magic happened, as they say. But for some reasons, this was this very odd thing when Richie Havens walked in. His presence is just a spiritual amazement that I just never saw.
Interesting. Oh, and we're at the end of our time.
Well, we'll have a chance to continue this on my show.
We will. And I wonder if you have any last words for the authors listening who are either doing book tours and getting on shows or want to.
Well, I just want them to know that it is very, very difficult. And if they feel frustrated by their hard efforts, just know that there is so much out there, and the way the media is, for the most part, they're not that inviting to authors. I just wouldn't want the authors to feel that they're personally not doing their part, because I just had Homer Hickam on, who wrote Rocket Boys that became October Sky, and he was just telling me, you know, Barry, there's just so few places I can go. And that's, I just don't want the authors to feel bad.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome, Barbara. I can't wait to meet you.
Me too.
And, by the way, may I just give up, my own son's a UCI student.
Oh, yes.
I didn't even get a chance to say that. Hi, Keen. I hope you listen.
I hope he is too.
It's a great school, and I'm glad to be on the station.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Barry Kibrick. He is creator and host of Between the Lines that you can see every night at 7 on KLCS-TV Los Angeles and on Sundays at 11. And he was speaking to us from L.A. Okay, we're at the end of our time. And if you want to know more, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And there's all sorts of things happening. And when I know the air date for the broadcast date for me on Barry's show, I will be sure to post it under appearances. So check that out when you can. I want to leave you with a quote by Joan Didion, who said, "So the point of my keeping a notebook has never been, nor is it now, to have an accurate, factual record of what I have been doing or thinking. Perhaps it never did snow that August in Vermont. Perhaps there never were flurries in the night wind, and maybe no one else felt the ground hardening and summer already dead, even as we pretended to bask in it. But that was how it felt to me, and it might as well have snowed, could have snowed, did snow." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.
Apple by looking at a tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at the mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudge me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, come on in closer, baby. Hear what else I gotta say. You got your radio turned down too low. Turn it up. Looking at the cane.